Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll talk about the Iraqi elections, where the reports are that there was much less violence than expected and a greater turnout than expected. We'll talk in a moment with Azam Alwash, who is the director of the Eden Again Project. He is in Jordan. He's just in Iraq a couple of days ago. And the Eden Project is the attempts to reverse the ecological holocaust that Saddam Hussein created with the marsh Arabs in the south, where he drained the swamps to essentially commit genocide against these ancient peoples. And this is one of those rare stories where somebody's actually trying to do something to reverse damage and repair and build. So we'll be talking to Azam Alwash about his feelings about this election. And I also did talk earlier to Dar Jamal, who is in Baghdad. He's an independent journalist. But the connection was so bad and kept breaking up that it's pretty difficult to hear. But he did tell me quite a few things, so I'll be able to take some of his questions. We'll also talk with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who served in the Reagan administration as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He's a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, having been an editor in columns for the Wall Street Journal, a fellow at the Hoover Institution. And what's interesting about him is the extent to which he is a vehement critic of the Bush administration. So we'll be talking to getting a conservative's point of view about why he thinks this administration is disastrous and has been captured by a cult. And then we'll talk with William Arkin, who's the author of a new book, Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. Bill Arkin is an NBC News military analyst. He's been a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And this book is a compendium of the activities of the United States military throughout the world in terms of sort of military empire building. And it's a great service to the public to find out the extent to what their taxpayer money is being used for and the extent of the U.S. military's reach, plans, and programs throughout the world. So we'll be talking to him. I'm speaking with Azam Alwash. How are you, Azam Alwash, who is in Jordan? I'm getting an echo here. He's the director of the Eden Again Project, and I take it you voted today in Jordan, right?
Yes, I did. Ian, good morning to you. Good afternoon here. It was an extraordinary feeling here in Jordan. There was quite a lot of people while I was participating in voting, even though it was the last day. Actually, probably it was because it was the last day. There was a lot of people participating in their very first free elections.
Well, I spoke earlier with an independent journalist who's in Baghdad. The connection was pretty bad. That's why I'm not playing it on the air. But he did. He contradicted largely what we're hearing in the press here is basically that there was much less violence than expected and much greater turnout, as high as 73%. He was suggesting that he didn't know how you could ever determine that figure. What kind of polling is actually taking place to determine that figure, and he felt that it was based upon the registration figure and that the way that people registered to vote, including the Sunnis who don't want to register to vote, that you had to sign up your registration in order to get your food rations. So is that how it worked?
You know, my information about how many people voted, of course, is all secondhand because I'm in Jordan. Mm-hmm. However, I am aware of the registration process, and the registration process in Iraq was based on ration cards, and whoever had ration cards was and over 18 was eligible to vote. And the signature of the ration card happened during the last distribution of rations, which I believe happened in December as well as January. If to get your rations, you need to sign the ration card to indicate that you in fact have collected your rations. Now, based on that, I believe the Independent Election Committee said that there was about 12 million eligible voters. Figures that I'm hearing here secondhand is that the turnout was really very big in southern Iraq, specifically in Basra and Najaf, where the turnout was more than 90% of the people who collect rations. I also heard in Baghdad there was somewhere around 70-73%, and unfortunately in Ramadi the turnout was a lot less, something or about 30%. Again, my information is secondhand from people that I've talked to in Baghdad.
But the Sunni the best participation on the part of the Sunni minority is about 30%, and they are 20% of the population, right?
30% of the eligible voters in Sunni or Sunni-dominated areas, Ramadi being such an area.
No.
These are the figures that I'm hearing. So, unfortunately, their voice is probably not going to be represented in the national elections or in the national assembly in the numbers that they actually reflect of the total population. And therefore, as far as I'm concerned, they are actually committing the same mistake that the Shia did back in 1920, when the Shia did not participate in full numbers in the referendum at that time. For the National Assembly, who is going to be in charge of writing the constitution, I believe that if they want to build an Iraq that is strong, that is not going to allow for the Sunnis to say that they are in fact disenfranchised in the new Iraq, the National Assembly needs to be very sensitive to this issue and make sure that the voices of the Sunni minority or the Sunni faction of the Iraqi fabric is represented in the discussion. That is very important, and I believe that the Shia leaders and the Kurdish leaders are in fact sensitive to this issue, and they, I believe, will make every effort to include them in the discussions.
Azam Al-Washagenya is the director of the Eden Again Project. He's in Jordan, and we're talking about the elections today in Iraq. And I spoke earlier with an independent journalist in Baghdad, but the connection was so bad that I couldn't really run it. So I'm sort of trying to use some of the comments that he made to run them by Azam. Obviously, the thing that seems to be overlooked in the coverage of this, at least in terms of context, is that this is an election to create an assembly whose main job is to create committees to write a constitution, and there will be a referendum on this constitution in October, and if that is ratified, then there will be the first real meaningful elections will take place in December. So is it possible, Azam, given the predominance of the Shia and the Kurds and the lack of turnout of 30% of the 20% of the population in terms of the Sunni, would in the committees, could they redress that imbalance by putting more Sunnis on the committees to write the constitution?
Not only is it possible, but I believe from discussions with political leaders and political influential people, I believe that is the intention. As you may know, or as your listeners may know, that the committees that are going to be put in charge of writing the Constitution need not be all from the elected National Assembly. They have the right to bring in experts and what have you, and I believe that is the mechanism that's going to be used to make sure that the voices of all the colors of the Iraqi fabric is included in the discussions. Because obviously they do not want to write a constitution. The National Assembly would not want to write a constitution that is going to fail. Incidentally, Section 60 of the Transitional Administrative Law allows or gives the majority of any three governments to reject the constitution, bringing it back for redrafting. That is a section that was added to ameliorate the fears of the Kurds that, in fact, a constitution would be written that would not give them the rights that they deserve. And at this point in time, it seems to me that it is, in fact, a section that could be used by the Sunnis to in fact, reject any constitution that does not or that takes away from their rights, as it were. Therefore, it's in everybody's interest to make sure that the voices of all sections or sectors of the Iraqi population is in fact included, because the three governments that have a majority Sunni, that is Mosul, Tikrit or Salah al-Din, and Ramadi, would not then reject the constitution.
Again, just to quote the journalist that I spoke to, who takes a different position, he was echoing much of what Brent Scowcroft recently said, President Bush Senior's National Security Advisor, who suggested that this election, rather than become the beginning of a U.S. exit strategy, may in fact precipitate and provoke a civil war. The argument was that more efforts should have been, because I said, well, you know, given that everybody thinks today was a big success, what's the alternative? And his suggestion was that there should have been, the Kurds and others wanted to delay the elections in order to do more diplomacy and to bring the Sunni in, and that the White House didn't want to delay the elections, and therefore they're pushing this thing too fast. So what's your feeling, Azhar Mahwash, on the bottom line question, which is, is this thing going to bring the country together and be a success, or is it going to, as people like Scowcroft have indicated, precipitate the breakup?
Of course, predictions are plentiful. I will tell you that the future is dependent on how the winners of this election are going to behave. As I told you previously, I believe that the leadership, the political leadership of both the Kurds and the Shia, as well as Dr. Alawi, are very sensitive to this issue, and I think they will go out of their way to make sure that whatever is written is palatable to all sectors, because it is in their interest to make sure that the Constitution is passed through the first time. Now, let's assume, for the sake of argument here, that in fact the predictions of dissolution of the nation of Iraq or the civil war issue is real. In fact, I believe that the geopolitical situation in the region does not allow for this dissolution to happen. But even if it did, let's talk about practical issues. How are you going to deal with Baghdad? The biggest population of Kurds in Iraq is in Baghdad. In fact, Baghdad is probably the largest Kurdish city in the sense if you just look at population. A lot of the Shia and Muslims are interrelated and intermarried, and my sister is one. You know, she's married to a Sunni. Now, what are you going to do about those? You know, the issue of the solution of the country is overblown. Just looking at the situation inside Baghdad, inside the political establishment in Baghdad, I see the Kurdish leadership taking a very active role in integrating the Kurds in the political structure of the central government. The Ministry of Water Resources, the Ministry of Municipalities, the Ministry, many of the major ministries are in fact Kurdish portfolios. I see the political leadership of Kurdistan having decided that they better have a bigger or a smaller slice of a bigger pie, given the geopolitical situation. I believe the Sunni leadership, when they see, and hopefully they will see, the efforts that are being taken to include their voices, I believe the remnants of the Ba'ath Party or the Ba'ath regime, as well as the extremists, are going to be marginalized over time. I am not saying that the violence is going to cease all of a sudden because of this election. I think, however, that over time, when the Sunni minority sees that in fact their rights are going to be preserved, and in fact that they're going to have a slice, an economic slice of the new Iraq, their support, or in fact they're going to start telling on their neighbors that are participating in these terrorist attacks.
And in terms of your work, you're doing something that is truly positive, which is to Saddam drained the marshes in the south to eradicate an ancient people, the Marsh Arabs. You're working on reversing that with your the Eden Project. How's that going along? Because you know, it's worth reminding the audience that Saddam Hussein was responsible for two of the greatest crimes against the planet: the burning of the oil wells in Kuwait and the draining of the marshes.
Ian, the draining of the marshes was termed by the United Nations Environmental Program, no less, as the worst engineered environmental disaster of the last century. It is in fact an instance where Saddam Hussein used the water or lack thereof as a weapon of mass destruction. As you said, an ancient culture that has lasted 7,000 years was almost destroyed. The good news, Ian, is that 40% of the former marshes are now inundated. Some 25% of it is really back to its vibrant state. People have started moving back into the marshes. The Ma'dan culture is very alive and well, thank you very much. It takes more than 10 years to kill such an ancient culture, fortunately. We are working with the people of the marshes to try to come up with an integrated plan that actually works on improving the infrastructure all around the areas of the south. And I'm working hand in hand with the Ministry of Water Resources, the Ministry of Municipalities and Public Works, and the Ministry of Transportation, as well as the Ministry of Oil, incidentally, to make sure that that the restoration is in fact not only is going to be good for the next 10 years, but I'm looking at ways of making sure that it will in fact outlast us all. I see the restored marshes as the engine of the economy of southern Iraq, besides the oil. I'm looking at trying to improve the ecotourism in the area. Let me tell you, when people think of Iraq, they think of desert. I wish they could see the marshes from where I see them. They are an incredible sight to behold. And by the way, I have learned a very good lesson in the past year and a half or 2 years of working in Iraq on restoring the marshes. Nature is very resilient. She is an incredible force.
Well, nature is resilient, but man, in many cases, is malignant. let me just end on the main question here. Azam Alwash, given that we went in there to free these people, and President in his inauguration talked about spreading liberty all around the globe, and it was clear that the peace was bungled, and that it was also clear that in retrospect that Saddam and the Ba'athists planned for an insurgency, and the insurgency has a new strain with a mixture of the Ba'athists, the secular Ba'athists, and the radical Sunni Wahhabis, and the real question is, will these same malignant thugs wear down the United States occupation? Already the Americans have not provided the Iraqis with basic security, so it's not clear that even with this election that the Iraqi people are going to trust the Americans and be free of the fear, which after all it was called the Republic of Fear. If you throw your lot in with the Americans, the Ba'athis and the Wahhabis will come by in the middle of the night and kill you. So where's the dynamics? It's been looking for the longest time that in fact the insurgents have the initiative. So what's your bottom line feeling on who has the initiative and how's it going to end up?
Well, of course, hindsight is always 20/20. It is obvious to me and to many people at this point in time that Saddam's strategy was always to dissolve and not to fight, and then to fight from behind the shadows, as it were. The whole system was set up for reorganization after the dissolution of the Iraqi government. You are right in the sense that they actually are taking the initiative and fighting from the shadows. However, it must be emphasized that the people that are doing the fighting are a very, very small minority of the entire nation, though they are doing a lot of harm. Let me also tell you that I think the fighting or the destruction of this, well, fighting of these remnants is not the job of the Americans. It should be the job of Iraqis and the Iraqi government. I believe that the United States made a big mistake by dissolving the army and by dissolving the police force. However, that's also hindsight. Let's look up to the future, and I believe that today is the very first step and a very, very long trip. I believe that the terrorists and the remnants of the of Saddam's regime are going to be with us for the next 5, 6, 7 years. But I believe as soon as the Sunni minority see that the new government or the new Iraq is in fact not going to disenfranchise them, I believe the wind is going to change, and those that are doing the fighting are going to have less and less space to operate. They operated with freedom in Fallujah. They still operate with freedom in Ramadi as well as Mosul. But soon, step by step, they will be fought. And the trick is to make sure that, in fact, the fighting is done by Iraqis, not by Americans. It is going to be a long-term struggle. These people do not want stability in Iraq. They do not want they want to return back to the way it was. Unfortunately for them, you cannot stop the clock. It is moving forward. The Iraqi people are sick and tired of 35 years of war. And the job of people like you and the Americans, I believe, is not in doing the fighting, but supporting the Iraqis to do the fighting.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Azam Alwash.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Azam Alwash, who is the director of the Eden Again Project. He's restoring the marshes in the south that were drained by Saddam Hussein. And he's in Jordan, having just been in Iraq. I got his perspective on the elections. I'm now speaking with Paul Craig Roberts, who is the chairman of the Institute for Political Economy and a research fellow at the Independent Institute. Dr. Roberts has impeccable conservative credentials, having been a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, having been the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under President Reagan, and also being an editor of the Wall Street Journal. Of course, the author of a new book, The Tyranny of Good Intentions. But lately you've been writing, Paul Craig Roberts, with I think quite a flair, but quite a sting in what you're saying. America's blundered into a needless and dangerous war, and fully half of the country's population is enthusiastic. Many Christians think that war in the Middle East signals an end of times, that they're going to be wafted up to heaven. Given what's happened today, are you a little bit chastened, or do you still believe that this kind of neoconservative cult that seems to have captured American foreign policy is taking us to hell in a handbasket?
Well, yes, it most certainly is. They're still in power. They haven't been held accountable. Nothing has happened today that would change anything. The whole thing was a strategic blunder. It was done intentionally. You can just look back and look at all of the changed explanations for why we went there. None of them hold.
When you say it wasn't done intentionally, Paul Craig Roberts, what was their intention, given the disastrous results?
It was a neocon agenda. It had nothing to do with the war on terror. It had to do, for example, to quote a neocon document that they wrote for the Israeli prime minister in 1996. This is a direct quote. It called for, quote, removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq, an important Israeli strategic objective in its own right. And then we had Pod Horowitz's article and commentary that was in September of 2004 about World War IV and how it started, what it means, why we have to win. He calls for basically overthrowing every government in the Middle East. The war has to go not just to Iraq, but to Egypt, Syria, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. They're all to be overthrown. So they have a very long, detailed record in the public record of advocating war in the Middle East to overthrow the existing regimes. And that's what it was about. The war on terror gave them an example. We know now for a fact, the whole world knows, about half the American population still doesn't know, but they're the only ones on the face of the earth that doesn't know, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There were no terrorists there. There were no connections to terror. They had nothing to do with 9/11. And the attack on Iraq had nothing to do with the war on terror. It had to do with the neocon agenda, a broader agenda. And terrorism was a cloak, a cover for them.
Well, you're suggesting in your writing that the neocons are like the Jacobins who brought about the French Revolution with unbridled idealism that turned into the Reign of Terror. So where do we stand, following your analogy, with this disaster of good intentions? Where is it leading us in terms of the analogy with the Reign of Terror?
Well, we're getting a police state here at home. That's what we're having in order to have a war on terror. The problem with the neocons is, yes, they are Jacobins, and people need to understand what it is to be a Jacobin. It's an ideology that stands outside the American tradition. It has nothing in common with our tradition or the founding fathers. It's the French Revolution view that we have the absolute virtue, and it's our obligation to impose it on the rest of the world. That was what started all the wars in Europe. It was the French Revolution trying to export itself to the rest of Europe. This is not an American idea. But the Jacobins, the new Jacobins, the neoconservatives, it is their idea. And it goes sort of hand in hand with their Israeli agenda. So the two things together are quite powerful. I think what the neoconservatives have done is to destroy the conservative movement in America.
But Paul Craig Roberts, I find it hard to believe that the Israelis are running the world and running this country. I mean, they can't even run the West Bank.
What do you mean, to succeed?
Well, I just don't believe they have that kind of influence and power. You know,
Well, you know, all of the it comes, if you pay much attention to reports, the Israeli lobby in Washington is considered to be the first or second most powerful lobby in the United States. But the neocons, you can read their own writings. They're available. They're not hidden. They're not. There's no conspiracy about it. It's just out in the open, and they do have an agenda for the Middle East, and it comes together with what they think should be Israel's agenda. And as I say, this paper that they published in 1996 was actually commissioned. It was done for the Israeli Prime Minister. And
Netanyahu at the time.
Netanyahu, yes.
Yeah, but again, following the Jacobin analogy, and it's pretty clear from President Bush's inauguration that he has this vision of spreading virtue, American-style virtue, around the world. I don't see how that relates to Israel's narrow strategic agenda in the Middle East. And as far as I know, from talking to people in Israel, particularly people in the intelligence services, Mossad and other people who are pretty knowledgeable, they think that the American incursion into Iraq has been a disaster and is likely to create a failed state in Iraq, which will then become a haven for terrorism, threaten Jordan, and then threaten Israel. So I don't see how this is working out for Israel.
There's no point arguing me about it, because it's the neoconservatives who say it. So read their papers and argue with them about it. Right. I'm just reporting what they say, and they're very, very explicit and clear about it. So it's not me saying that. It's them saying it, and I'm just telling you about it in answer to your question. I think what it means for the United States is that we're now in a strategic mess. We have probably made many of our puppets in the Middle East a lot less safe. I'm not sure what the future is for our puppet in Egypt or Jordan or Pakistan. At home here, the neocons have essentially destroyed the conservative movement. They've taken the conservative foundations. They have all of the forums, the former conservative forums, are in their hands. So the conservative movement in the United States is basically destroyed. So they are sort of it on that side of the spectrum.
Well, but you have to combine the neocons with the Christian right. That's the other people. I mean, people like Christian.
Well, now, okay, let's come back to your question, because why does the Christian right support them? Again, it's because of Israel and the wars in the Middle East and the neocons' agenda. So it sort of proves what I was telling you earlier. That's the Christian Zionists are in the neocon camp, and so it has to do with Israel.
Well, but the Christian right has agendas broader than Israel. They want to I mean, in terms of capturing the Republican Party, they are more interested in SpongeBob than they are in fixing the deficit. I mean, it's a whole. If you read the new book by Christy Todd Whitman, a former cabinet member in the first Bush administration, she's sort of tearing her hair out at the direction, you know, her book is titled It's My Party Too. So there's definitely a feeling amongst traditional Republicans that the party's been captured by...
Yes, Ian, that's true. But we're talking about the foreign policy.
Right.
And there, it's very important to the Christian evangelicals, the war in the Middle East, because of the connection in their minds to the end times, Armageddon, and the rapture. And there's a couple of, probably 20 million of these people, and they're very serious about it. And their interests, as you noted, come together with those of the neocons in foreign policy. I certainly agree they have domestic agendas that as well, but we were talking about the foreign policy.
Sure. Well, but what's your feeling, though? And I was amazed at how feckless John Kerry was in his campaign in not smoking President Bush out about his relationship to the end of times people, who, as you point out, there are 20 million at least. But remember, there have been 60 million copies sold of the end of times books by LaHaye, and it's the biggest bestseller in this country. So it may be a bigger movement than you're indicating, but nevertheless, what we need to know is our president, does he believe and share the same belief system as his core supporters? If so, then I would think the president would be impeachable, because you can't be the custodian of the nuclear arsenal and you can't be the steward of the environment and believe and have an investment in the end of the world.
Well, that's a very good point. And I think he's impeachable also for... taking the country into a gratuitous war on misrepresentations. You know, a lot of people have been killed. A lot of Iraqis have been killed. A lot of Americans. A lot of them are maimed. We have all the families who are affected by this. And what was it all about? It was about nothing. There was no reason for it to happen. We were deceived, betrayed. And so why isn't he held accountable? We don't have to even reach into the point you made to hold him accountable. The reason I think the Democrats have been so feeble and Kerry was so feeble was they're intimidated by the patriotism that rose up after 9/11, after September 11. And Bush has been very effective in saying that you're against us or you're for us. So if you aren't for us, you're criticizing us, that means you're against us. So it's very hard to get out of that sort of a box. He's effectively got Democrats in a box. If they criticize him, they're anti-American. They're against America.
But it's interesting that conservatives like yourself, and I've interviewed Pat Buchanan as well, and then traditional Republicans like Brent Scowcroft, are the most effective critics of this administration in the absence of a Democratic opposition. So... give me a sense of how many conservatives feel the way that you do.
Well, as I said, I don't think there are any conservatives left. The only conservative magazine I know of is called The American Conservative. It's brand new, something that Taki and Pat Buchanan and Scott McConnell put together, and it's a very small circulation. The
who are these people in the White House and in the Congress in the Republican Party? If they're not conservatives, what are they?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I think the conservative movement has morphed out of itself. It's not conservative in any traditional sense, certainly not the Republicans. To call the Republicans today conservatives is just not accurate. They're not.
Well, what would you call them, Paul Craig Roberts?
Brown shirts.
Wow. That's pretty strong.
They're delusional. They're delusional. They are intolerant of critics, of debate. They will not debate.
It's true. They're not exercising their...
They know their rights.
Right.
And if you're not with them, you're against them. And if you're against them, you're anti-American. It's a Jacobin mentality. I'd have to say the Republican Party has been... Jacobinized by the neocons. If you look at the major voices in the past, like I was an associate editor of the Wall Street Journal and columnist. I was a contributing editor to the National Review. Those publications today are unrecognizable from the conservative point of view that they represented a very short time ago when I was associated with them. They are just totally unrecognizable. They're not conservative. What's the one in Washington this Crystal fellow runs?
The Weekly Standard, right.
Yeah, well, there's nothing conservative about that. These are not conservatives. They're Jacobins, and their influence on the Republican Party is very bad. I think the party, in the end, may be destroyed by this strategic blunder of invading a country on false pretenses, particularly if they can't get out, if they can't extract themselves from this mess. And particularly if they go further and actually attack Iran, like they keep indicating they intend to do. So the potential for a really huge catastrophe is great. And all the time, the dollar is collapsing. The dollar is the world's reserve currency. The reason the United States is a superpower is because the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. That role lets us forced off these massive debts that we create in our trade deficits, our budget deficits, on the rest of the world. Now, how long can the dollar slide the way it's been sliding and keep this role as reserve currency? And if it gets abandoned as reserve currency, it'll be an economic crisis of an amazing dimension. And if that comes together with a political crisis, a military crisis in the Middle East, it'll be disastrous for the United States. And no one's thinking about this. They're full of hubris. We're a superpower. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. They can't do anything. They can't occupy Baghdad. You know, it should strike people by now that the United States, with its 8 divisions and its superpower, cannot occupy Baghdad, much less Iraq.
Well, just in closing then, Paul Craig Roberts, who is going to, given that we have a kind of one-party state here and that the you feel that the Republicans have become brown shirts, but they're not exercising their role in the Senate or the House. They're ciphers of the White House, and that's why it's a scary prospect of this one-party government. There's not the traditional tensions and checks and balances between the branches of government. Who's going to and what's going to revive American democracy?
I don't know, because we have put in place all of the framework of a police state, and the Bill of Rights is essentially gutted. That they could come and arrest you and me right now and simply say we're enemy combatants, and we'd disappear. We'd never have a lawyer. We'd never be produced in a court. The whole thing, you know, if the Democrats don't start being an opposition party and speaking out very forcefully, there's just no way to check them. Perhaps in 2 years, the American people will have woke up, or enough of them, and the Republicans will lose the House. Maybe that would be some check. But I don't know where it's going to come from. You know, the few voices that are screaming at them, we don't have any legions. And we get screamed at by the brown shirts. They say, well, you're for Saddam Hussein. You're against America. So they don't even know what America is anymore. The Bill of Rights, who needs that? We got a war on terror. We don't have a war on terror. We have a war on Islam.
Well, if that's true, then we're in for a rough ride. I thank you very much for joining us, Paul Craig Roberts.
Yes, well, thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Paul Craig Roberts, who is the chairman of the Institute for Political Economy and a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's formerly an assistant secretary of the Treasury under President Reagan, a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and an editor of the Wall Street Journal. So those are fairly strong conservative credentials, along with being the author of a book, The Tyranny of Good Intentions. And I'm now speaking with William Arkin, who's the author of a new book, Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. And Bill Arkin is an NBC News military analyst, consultant, and author. He also was a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And this book that you've done, William Arkin, really does a great service to the taxpayer who's paying for and has always paid for this vast military that the United States has that dominates the world. I think we spend more on the military than everybody combined by a huge factor. I notice actually a change, and just maybe this may be a little off the subject a little bit, but I've noticed throughout the Cold War, the military contractors, of course, were cleaning up at the trough, but they kept a low profile. Now you can't turn on the television without seeing ads from Boeing and Lockheed Martin basically selling patriotism and what a great service they do. Is this money essentially taxpayer money? I mean, how do you pass out whether or not they're using taxpayers' money to promote their own agenda?
Well, let me just say, Ian, thank you for having me on the show. it's easy to lament how things are today and be a little ahistoric about how things have been. After all, it was President Eisenhower who warned us originally about the military-industrial complex, and I oftentimes these days when I hear President Bush speak about the threat of Islam as something that is the gravest threat we've ever faced, as if somehow this is worse than the Cold War, when the United States and the Soviet Union could have blown each other both up with nuclear weapons, I have to not just laugh, but think that the American public is being given a real disservice in terms of the threat. And so I think one of the reasons why I wrote this book was both to empower people to understand that this isn't men's work and that they have a better chance of grasping what is going on in the national security world, and by virtue of that being more knowledgeable and participating. But also it's responding to a very positive aesthetic that's also going on in our society today, which is the aesthetic of the 9/11 families, a powerful group of very engaged citizens who are demanding reform and, in fact, have been powerful enough to actually push through reform, as flawed as it might be. The phenomenon of the 9/11 families is the sort of the epitome of what we think of when we think of an engaged citizenry. And to me, that is based upon their own psychological scars from the 9/11 event as well, but also I think the unfinished business of 9/11, which is to say that the government never really gave the American public the accountability and the care that it required after 9/11. It launched into a war almost immediately and followed that war up with the Iraq War, and never really took the time to be accountable to the public, either in terms of taking responsibility for what happened on 9/11 or being accountable to the public in terms of asking the public what it really wanted in terms of Iraq and the war on terror. And so I listened to your last guest, and I guess on some level, while I think that there's been unprecedented secrecy in the Bush administration and we've gotten ourselves into a terrible quagmire in Iraq, on the other hand, there are some positive signs, and we do live in a country in which I can publish a book like this, which contains lots of government secrets, and I'm not particularly worried about brown shirts, or I'm not particularly worried about government action against me. This is also the positive elements of the United States.
Well, I agree with you, and in fact, too often on the left, these paranoid fantasies about government power end up paralyzing people into inactivity. And power is, after all, what you give to others. So the worst thing you can do is feel alienated from your government. I mean, after all, you pay their bills. You have every right to know what's going on.
Well, exactly. And I think that in the case of secrecy, I've heard a lot of criticism over the last week that this book has been out, compromising national security and compromising intelligence sources and methods and compromising military operations. And my response to that, first of all, is you have to understand the purpose of secrecy. Most secrecy today that I'm writing about is secrecy which is intended specifically to hide the politically sensitive. And what is politically sensitive? Politically sensitive is when our government is undertaking practices that are otherwise unacceptable to the American public, torture or domestic spying, developing weapons that are repugnant to the American public, right? Microwave weapons, laser weapons, dealing with repressive regimes or compromising our principles and dealing with nations overseas, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, etc. So to me, what I see is a trend more and more towards classification, which is intended to essentially cut the public out of knowledge of activities that our government is undertaking, which most people in the public would question. And it doesn't really have anything to do with protecting an intelligence source or method or an ongoing operation. And I think that the government often is in a position of uttering the word national security, and we tend to back off and accept that it's merely men's work and that the normal citizen can't be privy and can't be competent enough to involve themselves. But I hope that that could change, and that certainly was my small act of defiance by saying, okay, let's just at least all be singing off of the same sheet of music and at least have some sense of what the totality of the activities of the U.S. military are today.
Well, again, let me remind the audience I'm speaking with William Arkin, who's the author of a new book, Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. And Bill Arkin's an NBC News analyst and formerly a columnist with the Los Angeles Times. And the book really does lay out the full scope, which most, I think, 99.99% of the people aren't aware of, this full scope and activities of the U.S. military in its global reach, and it is quite an extraordinary compendium. And just to sort of clarify what I was suggesting earlier, Bill, about the notion that now the military-industrial complex is advertising their virtue to the taxpayers who essentially subsidized them. That never happened during the Cold War. Neither did the wholesale privatization of national security. It seems to me that under this new regime that Rumsfeld has begun at the Pentagon, in effect, they're double dipping. They not only make all of this money from weapon systems and all these expensive programs, by privatizing the activities that were previously done by the enlisted men, you have this phenomenon now. For example, the special forces, who are the best trained elite American soldiers, they're having a hard time maintaining retention because the private contractors are cherry picking all of the special forces people, and they're paying a shooter $1,000 a day in Baghdad. You can imagine the trickle-down economics, what the people at the top are getting. We've heard stories about all the money that Halliburton's getting. So it seems to me that I can't believe how the public's asleep at the switch not to see how unjust and what a bad deal it is to privatize the military.
Well, we've seen this trend, Ian, towards the age of consultants long before current administration, and it is a significant shift in our society, and particularly in national security terms. You know, it used to be the case probably before the Reagan administration, so just 20 years ago, that people would come to Washington, and then when they were done in Washington, they would leave and go home. And then something happened in the Reagan administration and in the Reagan years, and we saw increasingly congressmen and former soldiers, generals, retire and stay in Washington and become part of the gravy train of lobbyists and consultants. And that's really what began all of this trend. It's also a trend that I think we've seen in other businesses as well. Now, with declines in the defense budget during the 1990s, consulting to undertake support functions for the military became more popular. It was a cheaper way of doing certain services for the military, because despite the fact that the enlisted men and women in the armed forces might be not paid very much themselves, the cost of personnel overall, pay, benefits, housing, veterans, benefits, etc., really is a very big tail behind that tooth. And that trend towards greater involvement in contractors with services for the military has really ballooned during the Bush administration, probably because the military tasks have become so stretched thin, and there's a greater and greater need for these organizations to do more and more of the work. There's sort of two effects that I think it has on the American public. I mean, one is that it gives a sort of distorted view of the actual resources that we're putting into these kinds of things. We can say that we only have 140,000 troops in Iraq, but the reality is that there are tens of thousands of additional workers who are on the American payroll, and that's a kind of hidden force. And then on top of that, of course, your Halliburtons and your SAICs and your Kellogg, Brown, and Roots are not accountable. They're only accountable to the military. They're not accountable to the American public. And so we do see on the other side of that coin, more and more of those companies involved in actual planning and military decision-making and in a lot of the paperwork associated with national security. And that has created a syndrome of lesser and lesser accountability that I think is far more dangerous than the minor tax penalty that we may be paying for the privatization.
But still, it seems obvious that in this war in Iraq, which I understand, and you've obviously got really good military contacts, the military aren't very happy about the situation that they're in. The focus on the soldiers there is basically to protect each other, and then nobody is particularly comfortable with this mission. And particularly in retrospect, finding out that all the reasons that they went in there for turn out to be bogus. But you can say that the contractors are the people who are actually benefiting this war. If the Iraqi people aren't benefiting, and if the American soldiers aren't benefiting, and the American taxpayers not benefiting, there's no question that the contractors are benefiting.
Well, the immediate beneficiaries are definitely the contractors. There's no question. Though I would also remind the listeners that many contractors have been killed as well as wounded in Iraq.
Right.
I think that there's no question that there's a benefit, but that's also a financial benefit that is not unknown to the American public. We may be not happy with the way in which that money is being spent, or be unhappy with the course of reconstruction in Iraq, which I certainly think there's room for complaint about. It certainly is something that has led to the insurgency and to the negative situation there by virtue of not having the amenities of modern life quickly restored in Iraq. But again, to me, the military is many different creatures, just are the contractors are many different creatures. I sometimes have a difficult time characterizing, quote, the military. It's not one thing. There are Democrats, there are Republicans, there are apolitical people in the military, there are those who are very savvy about the world at large, and there are those who are oblivious to what the politics of their trade are. But what I have noticed in the past year or so, since the initial assault on Fallujah in April 2004, was that the military is definitely less and less gung-ho about the mission in Iraq and do see themselves as being in a bit of a quagmire.
Well, and Bill, I'm afraid we've run out of time. Your book, Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World, the book itself is a great public service, and I thank you for it.
Thanks for having me on your show, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with William Arkin, who's the author of a new book, Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs and Operations. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer. This program and all previous programs are available at ianmasters.org.